Shrink Wrap Radio number 521, Narcissism in the Era of Donald Trump, with psychiatrist Leonard Cruz.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is psychiatrist Dr. Leonard Cruz. He's co-founder of the Asheville Jung Center, the editor-in-chief of Chiron Publications, and co-edited the 2016 book, A Clear and Present Danger, Narcissism in the Era of Donald Trump. For more information about Dr. Leonard Cruz, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Rhythms, Sleep, and Dreams. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Leonard Cruz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, David.
Well, it's about time. It's great to have you on the show. And we've sort of been shadow figures in a way for each other because Chiron Publications, which you are a co-founder of, is a non-monetary strategic partner kind of relationship that we have to assist one another in ways that we can in terms of publicizing and so on. And your partner is Steve Buser, who I did interview about a book that the two of you wrote together on the DSM-5. So it's good to have this opportunity to finally see you and get a sense of who you are.
Well, you're to be commended. You know, Steve and I, when we started the Asheville Jung Center 8 years ago, and I should clarify, we are not the founders of Chiron, but we assumed its management a few years back. We've had this quiet understanding that he will remain the face and the voice of our enterprises, but somehow you've managed to draw me out. So kudos to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad for your willingness. The two of you actually edited another very timely book. I think it's just come out, and it's titled Clear and Present Danger, Narcissism in the Era of Donald Trump, which we'll be discussing here. But before we get into that, let's have you say a bit about your own background.
Well, I started out, you know, it may not be known to your audience that I'm a psychiatrist, first of all. And, you know, my interest in Jung actually goes all the way back to my residency years. I actually attended a residency in Portland, Maine that was pretty heavily classical psychoanalytic. The chair was a training analyst from Columbia, and I was chief resident for my last year, and that involved actually analytic supervision. But I actually remember sneaking into one of my professor's offices who had the collected works. I'll even acknowledge him. His name's Walt Christie, and he's an important member of the Jungian community in Maine.
Okay.
And I would sneak in there and borrow a copy of one of the volumes, and I read through the entire works, actually, at that time. So
wow.
I had a long interest. Yeah, but you know, the funny thing is, I now look back and realize when you're in your mid-20s, you're not really ready to encounter Jung, and mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure I wasn't. But so, you know, the idea came to Steve and I back about 8 years ago of doing the Asheville Jung Center, and that was the next step. Turns out I also have gone to business school on a couple occasions and have a graduate degree in business.
So, oh, good. So there's some business smarts behind all this.
There was. That's kind of how Steve and I have been such a good partnership. So yeah. When Murray and Nathan Schwartz-Lant actually invited us to assume the management of Chiron, that worked out nicely because I've always been a voracious reader and I write. So
it's been just a joy and a delight.
Yeah, that's great. Well, we're going to start digging into your book here, and I'm going to hold it up for the camera just so that people can kind of see it. It's got this wonderfully provocative title, Narcissism in the Era of Donald Trump. What's the background of the book? How did it come about? What was the motivation behind it?
You know, about 4 months ago, late March, early April, the idea had been stewing in me that it would be a timely occasion because of Trump and the way that he's sort of manifested himself, and frankly, the other candidates as well, might offer a unique opportunity to shed some light on the subject of narcissism. And it happened that on an early weekend in April, I was listening to NPR's weekend edition, and Arianna Huffington was being interviewed on her new book regarding sleep. And she made a comment that really stuck with me. And it was that she said that when they started out covering Donald Trump, they did it as entertainment news, and that she was really intent on staying with that idea. But what happened was he then made the announcement about banning 1.6 Muslims from entering our country. And her words were actually that that's when it became evident to her that covering him as news was imperative because he had become a clear and present danger. And that struck a chord with me because I like reading Supreme Court cases. And it turns out that phrase, a clear and present danger, comes directly from a Supreme Court case from the early 1900s involving free speech. So I thought, you know, things just, as they're apt to do sometimes, they coalesced for me. And I came in the next Monday and talked to Steve about, what would you think of gathering some people together and asking the impossible, which is what we did. We asked people to contribute a chapter within 30 days. And wow. Even the ones who resisted, I kind of compelled them by saying, you know, some people would say that Jung dealt with his inner Nazi, but if you were a Jew in Europe, you probably would have appreciated if he had dealt with his outer Nazi. And with that kind of shaming of influence, I managed to compel a lot of people to join up.
Yeah, well, I have to congratulate you because my impression of Jungians, the Jungian movement and so on, is very internally oriented. And I think this is sort of a unique instance of stepping forward, of a bunch of Jungians stepping forward and planting their flag. And, yes.
And in actually engaging the culture in
yeah,
a way.
Yeah, and I should hasten to mention here that the book is not all about, quotes, trashing Trump, because a number of the articles really pull back and look at the culture. And there are some fairly sympathetic views of people who are supporting Trump. I'd say exactly. that's a mixed bag, but at least some people were able to take that kind of a stance.
Steve and I actually had some vigorous conversations as the book was in development about the cover. And one of the concerns I had was, I won't deny the cover is compelling and the title is compelling, and that's
provocative. It's compelling and provocative. Yeah.
But on the flip side, I thought it slightly misleading because not only perhaps only a third of the chapters even mention Trump, but they also mention the other candidates, and it really is a study of narcissism, much more so than the current environment.
Yeah, that's good. And, you know, you say that the book is not diagnosing Donald Trump. There are lots of disclaimers there that we're not doing that. But that's an issue, evidently, that was faced before back in the days of Barry Goldwater. So take us, and I thought that was a really interesting background that I think was in the preface. Take us through that issue as it was expressed in that Barry Goldwater and the American Psychiatric Association.
You know, that the story behind that became something of a blemish for the American Psychiatric Association and psychiatry in America in general, but it harks back to the election in 1964 when Barry Goldwater was a candidate, and there were some people who saw his brand of He had a kind of a firebrand approach, and he was very outspoken. And some people kind of perceived him as somewhere between a demagogue in the making and a madman. And so a magazine sent out, I think it was slightly more than 12,000 questionnaires to a psychiatrist across the nation, asking them to opine on whether they thought that Barry Goldwater was, number one, fit for office, and was he mentally fit? Well, it turns out that out of that 12,000 surveys that were sent out, only about a fifth of them were actually returned. And even within that small, you know, proportion of returned surveys, there were probably about only 50% that, number one, asserted that he was not mentally fit. But in there, they provided the opportunity for comment. And so some people didn't spare words in mentioning that this guy was a lunatic, that he was psychopathic. I mean, they extended themselves into making some fairly bold assertions that pretty much did border on diagnosis. Well, Barry Goldwater sued. He sued the publisher, and he eventually prevailed. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he did eventually prevail. But interestingly enough, even one of the justices who wrote a dissenting opinion, Hugo Black, said that, you know, when it came to matters of somebody ascending to the presidency, a position of such importance, that he was pretty much giving carte blanche, that they were opening themselves up to all sorts of scrutiny. So he actually dissented. But the American Psychiatric Association, I think, in the wake of that, felt as though they were embarrassed by the fact that people took their clinical positions and made these, you know, bold and sometimes fairly exaggerated assertions. So they promulgated a rule that came to be known as the Goldwater Rule, in which it was expressly discouraged as an ethical violation to make a diagnosis of a public figure whom you had not interviewed and had secured permission to give the opinion publicly. Though I'll say that controversy is not settled, because there was a couple of authors in a journal even earlier this year, in the American Journal of Law and Psychiatry, who came out and said that they really perceived that as a professional society overreaching and overreacting to an embarrassing moment. So I think the jury, you could say, is still out with regard to whether professionals should even step into that zone. You know, part of me, I think we tried to be as respectful as we could, but there is a part of me that thinks it's an odd circumstance where laity and people with no experience can freely opine, but those people who have a vast amount of experience ought to be silenced. That seems kind of an odd thing, but I understand its origins.
Yeah, so I understand there's this conflict of people who feel like, hey, this guy is in the public eye.
Right.
He's saying all this stuff that's there for anybody to read and see. And so being the professionals that we are, we can draw some conclusions. And there are people on the other side that are saying, well, it's not the same as somebody that you've met with one-on-one in the private consulting room and so on. Efforts in the past, historical efforts to create a psychological profile of, right, of major political figures have sometimes turned out to be quite flawed.
True. And that's so true. You know, in this case, I think there's a couple things maybe that mitigate, and if nothing else, it certainly energizes the conversation around the subject. One of the things I think matters is Donald Trump himself, he read it or became aware of a book titled The Productive Narcissist that's written by an analyst from Washington, D.C. And he kind of gladly identified himself as, and almost kind of boasted of the fact that he sees himself as a productive narcissist in the way that Michael Maccabee had written. So, you know, in a way, in fact, Steve discouraged me, and I think wisely so, but I wanted to submit the book to Mr. Trump, because it seemed to me, as far as I knew, he might very well be flattered that we had made these comments.
I don't know. The narcissist in him might just be really glad that you've written this book. On the other hand, he's known to be pretty tetchy.
And, yes. I mean, we were very careful. And when I sent out the invitation to the contributors, I really emphasized to them that it was imperative that we try and stay away from anything that would be deemed as libelous. And I think we did a fine job of that. You know, as for whether people were certainly implying that he had narcissistic traits, that in the few chapters where he is a subject, I think that there'd be no denying.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting. In some of the chapters, it's also been made clear that it's probably fair to say that of any of the people running for high office, that there has to be a certain amount of narcissism even to just presume to aspire to the presidency.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally supportive of this project that you've done. And at the same time, as I was reading the necessary disclaimers at the beginning of the book, I thought, well, this could be a tad disingenuous, because in fact, it reminds me of Trump himself, who'd say something like, well, I haven't seen Obama's birth certificate. Of course, I don't know. You know, right. Of course, I don't know. It's just kind of a mumbled thing. Okay, the big idea is out there. This guy is not born in the U.S., but I don't know. And so here we're saying...
we're not diagnosing him.
Yeah, we're not diagnosing you, but...
He thinks the man protests too much. Yeah. No, you know, that's a fairly... I think that might be a fair critique. As much as I wished that people would notice the subtlety in the subtitle. You know, the subtitle was intentionally crafted as "In the Era of Donald Trump."
Yes.
In order to convey this notion that this really isn't about Donald Trump. If anything, I think what we could fairly say is that person of Donald Trump has galvanized something about the way narcissism plays out in our culture. Remember, he's been a celebrity for decades. He's been a reality television star. So, you know, the hope in that subtitle was to convey the idea that really what's being addressed here is something beyond this moment in time historically, and also beyond this figure individually, that really speaks to, in this era in which he has risen and ascended to this nomination, there's something going on that cuts deeper than that. That's really the intent. But I think it's easy to miss that. And you might be right that there's a quality of some degree of messenger.
Be careful not to knock the table. I'm hearing your mic getting, something's transmitting through the table, probably to the mic.
Okay.
So as you get carried away and start to gesticulate.
It seems like since you couldn't see it on camera, I was safe, but I can tell that's not the case.
Okay. Well, maybe we should start off by anchoring this a bit with the DSM-5 actually has a diagnosis, I guess, for the narcissistic personality disorder, or some people in the book said NPD. And maybe you could just give us the outline of that.
Yeah, you know, in brief, I think it's useful to keep in mind that when we talk about personality disorders in general, and this would certainly be true of narcissistic personality disorder, we're really talking about people who, their character, their personality, those stable traits that we refer to as personality, they are they have certain qualities that make them very maladaptive, and that produces problems. You know, one of the things I think is always an interesting thing to look at when thinking about personality disorders is, you know, perhaps it's a function of having practiced for 30 plus years, but I still remember the days in which in the early DSM, I think DSM-2 was where it last appeared, the world of diagnoses got divided into neurotic and psychotic.
Yes.
And I recognize that we've made advances, but, you know, some things got lost in that advance. And one of them is, you know, we thought, when I think of neurotic, I think of people who, when something goes awry in the world, they tend to look interiorly to see some causation within themselves. You know, that's a big part of the neurotic drama. Whereas people with personality disorders, I think, uniformly look outside themselves for the cause of trouble. And sometimes that's almost an impenetrable wall to help people see how they are their own authors of their own difficulties. So I think with narcissistic personality disorder, that's certainly true, that quality of overbearing, imposing, sometimes self-aggrandizing, those qualities that we associate with narcissistic personality disorder, you know, it can cause a substantial amount of suffering outside of the individual who's afflicted. And they may or may not even be aware of that. Typically, they're not. And if they do become aware of any difficulties, commonly it'll be located outside themselves. So, you know, I think the other thing about narcissistic personality disorder that's useful to be mindful of has to do with the idea that people with that phenomenon often treat people in the same way as we treat objects. You know, if I get a brand new car, for a while I might feel enhanced because the car is spotless and impeccable, but then somebody dings it in the parking lot and suddenly it loses its luster, and there's a strange exchange between me and the thing where somehow I'm diminished when the thing is less valued. Well, I think people with narcissistic personality disorder frequently treat human beings in the same way. As long as you're acclaiming me and affirming me, you're a useful thing. But yes, the moment that ceases, I disdain you and I toss you aside like something that's no longer useful.
Yes, yes. And I think we've been seeing some of that.
On both sides of the political spectrum.
Okay. One of the things that struck me as I was going through some of the articles in the book is different takes that the authors have on narcissism. Evidently, it's a much more complicated topic than can be easily encapsulated.
You know, one of the most delightful things in assembling that particular group of contributors, although each of them was given some direction, I can't say that each of them necessarily followed the direction they were given.
Yeah.
And that was really a blessing in disguise. To give you a couple of particular examples, I think really stand out to me. We approached Jim Hollis, you know, who's written another book for Chiron, Hauntings. And he's written 12 or 13 books even before that, a hugely popular author. And what we asked him was, really, would you mind, Jim, just giving us sort of a survey of the myth itself? He said, I'd be willing to do that, but would you allow me to instead take off in a different direction? And I asked him what he had in mind, and he said, well, I'd really like to take off from the perspective of Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground. Well, it had been years since I had read that, so that evening I went home and I read it, and I realized, to my delight, that the narrator of that story is a profound narcissist. And so there goes the chapter that Jim wrote that has to do really with how does narcissism manifest in that story, and how does it kind of invite us to what he describes as the forlorn hope that, you know, Narcissus is really trying to fall in love with something, but it turns out the image of himself is sort of static and empty and vacuous, and therein lies that forlorn hope. Or another one that I thought was really provocative was, I invited a guy by the name of James Wiley, who wrote a book that I remembered as very meaningful. It was a book titled The Phallic Quest. So I found him, I tracked him down. He lives in Oaxaca, Mexico, of all things. He's a retired analyst down there who loves to play Baroque music on original instruments. Huh. And he said, I don't really have anything to offer. And I said, well, you know, Jim, I just think you're wrong. Here's what I'd like you to do. And I asked him to write on the masculine and the feminine and its relationship to the narcissist myth. Well, turns out he's become quite an accomplished artist. And so his chapter regards the way that in art, men and women are depicted when looking at their reflection in a mirror. And it turns out that, and I'd never really noticed this, but women are generally depicted in this very serene, placid, really self-possessed way, whereas men are almost always depicted in tortured, very anguished fashion. And that was not at all what I intended, but it was far better than anything I might have imagined.
Wow. Well, let's step through some of these articles that you've mentioned and some that you haven't mentioned, and relying on what you can remember about them, because I know it's been a while since you edited them all,
right,
and what I might remember. And let's start with the article that you wrote, which I love the title. It's titled Trumpel-Stiltskin. Trumpel-Stiltskin, Narcissism and the Will to Power. So I remember Rumpelstiltskin as a fairy tale that I was exposed to as a kid. So it's kind of neat the way you've grabbed onto that. So give us a brief recap of the fairy tale, and then tell us how that applies to Trump.
Well, it was funny. I was actually in conversation with Clarissa Pinkola Estes when, and we were talking about a variety of things, and the book was just one of them. But and she asked me what kind of ideas I had. And I told her that, you know, for my chapter, I wanted to write about the will to power, but that I kept being visited by this image of Rumpelstiltskin. Though I confess, at the time I talked to her about it, I didn't even really remember the fairy tale myself. It just kind of came to me as one of those sort of whole experiences. So I did eventually look up the fairy tale, and I realized there were many reasons why it appealed to me. And in short, the fairy tale is about a man who is a miller, and he encounters the king one day, and feeling inadequate himself, he boasts to the king that my daughter can spin gold out of straw. Well, the king tells him, if that's the case, I want to meet her. And so he brings his daughter to fulfill this basic lie that he's done in order to kind of deal with his own sense of inadequacy. And at that point, the story unfolds where on three different occasions, the king demands that the miller's daughter spin gold out of straw. And she's, of course, distressed. And suddenly appears this smallish kind of deformed creature that in my recounting happens to have large hands. But and he's able to actually do the magic. But what he extracts from her at first is a promise of one thing. I think it's a necklace, and then it's a ring. And eventually on the third occasion, he requires that if the king marries her and they have a child, that if he spins gold one more time, she will give up her child. And I think that's kind of a vital part of the story, because this smallish figure, he's not content to acquire riches and things. He wants the very soul of the feminine. He wants the thing most precious to her. So for me, it became a story that, as I sat with it, was not an unreasonable facsimile of some of what we've witnessed with Donald Trump's ascendancy, in that, you know, if I think of what's the soul of America, I think of it as being in some ways that idea that wave after wave of immigrants have come to this country and built it anew. Mm-hmm. We're all part of a diaspora before we arrive here and claim this as home. I myself am a child of a Cuban American, of a Cuban. So I'm a Cuban immigrant in a sense, even though I was born here. And, you know, our national motto is E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. So I thought it's interesting that what Donald Trump, and perhaps even on the other side, they've done something similar, has done is they've taken something that's really a vital part of the soul of our nation, and they wish to possess it and to exploit it for their own selfish gain. So that's why the story, I think, kept visiting me in images and thoughts before I actually even went back to read it. And in the end of that story, it turns out it's kind of not unlike what we find now with dealing with narcissists in general, that you have to call them out by name. And once you do, they become so furious and so intemperate that they begin to stomp around. And in the fairy tale, what happens is Rumpelstiltskin stomps around until his leg gets driven into the ground, and he's so angry, he tries to pull the other leg, and he tears himself in two and self-destructs. And there's something, some people suggested that that may very well be the path of people who inflate themselves too much in the public eye.
Yeah, yeah, good. Anything else in your, that captures a lot of what you have to say in the article, but you actually cover a lot of topics. Is there another one that you'd like to hit before we move on? For example,
yeah, maybe the theme of my chapter that I tried to flesh out was really that narcissism can be understood as sort of a compensation for a sense of inferiority. And in that regard, I admit I kind of like the idea of introducing Alfred Adler, who is an early analyst that doesn't get a lot of play in Jungian circles, frankly, doesn't get a lot of play generally. But I think he had a lot of very novel ideas regarding this idea that we all carry around in us a sense of inferiority that we often, if it's in extreme, we may deal with in two different fashions. In one manner, we might become sort of unable to muster a response to life. We become sort of defeated before we even try. Or in the other extreme, it may be that you develop what he referred to as a superiority complex, which has a lot of similarities to narcissism. And I speak in the chapter a little bit about how, since that's something that is embedded in all of us, it's a way of understanding how is it that a charismatic leader who's sort of possessed of a lot of narcissism, how could they resonate with our own inferiority feelings? And thereby we might feel lifted up in that dance with the narcissistic leader.
Uh-huh, yeah, you use that expression, the dance with Trump. So in other words, there's a mutual kind of influence, or not influence, but Trump or whoever that political leader out there is maybe resonating with something within ourselves. And so we have a...
Yeah, I even see that as perhaps being true in the election of 2008, where, you know, if you think of those phrases that were uttered with such power and such compelling force, yes, we can. You know, in that instance, it may have had a very positive valence, and it was very inspiring, but in a way, I think we should be just as circumspect about the positive, inspiring leader who we invest with all the powers to lift us up, because the downside of that is we become reliant on that leader and fail to step up and take responsibility as adults and as full citizens. You know, again, I think there's a trap there that, you know, for those of us who feel like we aren't able to make a difference, somebody can sweep in and even with a very positive message, deceive us into thinking that we're making a difference, and it may or may not be fulfilled if we don't step up and engage.
Yeah, good point. Earlier, you mentioned Jim Hollis, who I've had the privilege of interviewing a couple of times. He starts off with the Narcissus myth, and I think we all sort of think we know about that, but there are depths to it. And he mentioned nemesis, and I'm aware of the nemesis, of the way we use nemesis as a synonym for enemy or somebody who, you know, who's our opponent.
Right.
I somehow had lost track of that being any part of the myth. Maybe just give us the highlight again of that myth, including nemesis.
You know, it's funny. I think it escapes me too, even though it wasn't that long ago I read it. But if I remember, nemesis is the one who essentially imposes the curse upon Narcissus, if I remember.
Okay.
And that curse for Narcissus is, of course, that he would fall in love with his own image as he casts his gaze into that reflecting pool. And of course, the part of the myth that we almost all do remember is the part with Echo, in which she falls in love with this beauty. Remember, he's this youthful, just extraordinarily handsome delight to look at. And he's sort of the coveted object of everyone. And Echo is only able to speak back what somebody else says. That's her sort of dilemma. And she's a sprite, I think it is. And so when Narcissus comes upon his own reflection, he's just enthralled with it. And that's a big theme in Jim's chapter, is the way in which that experience of being very captivated by your own image can at first seem sort of enlivening, but it's really empty of any substance. And if you remember in the way the myth unfolds, he stays there so transfixed by his own image that he gets no nourishment, he gets no water, and he eventually meets his death there. And out of that same spot flowers the bud of the flower that we know as the Narcissus. So, I mean, it's a tale that really is a cautionary tale about how easily we can be enthralled with our own beauty, with our own extraordinary nature, such that we don't even engage outwardly at all, and we become sort of consumed by our own fascination.
Yeah, you know, another point that I took from Jim's chapter is the need to acknowledge our own narcissism and our tendency to project. So it's really we can have a lot of energy around pointing at Donald Trump and saying, "Oh my God, I can't believe what a narcissist that guy is," which relieves us from having to really look at ourselves and at our own narcissism. And the more repellent that is to us personally, the more likely we are to project it onto somebody else. And Donald Trump is a very convenient screen for that.
You know, that was actually one of the, going back to your earlier question, David, about what was the hope? That was actually one of the very sincere hopes, was that this might be an invitation to, if you will, own our own narcissism, own our own shadow, not be so subject to projecting onto the figure of an inflated, charismatic leader, but to realize that, you know, even those who may be very opposed to Donald Trump's candidacy ought to not ignore the fact that he has resonated, and quite effectively, with this thing that grips a large segment of the electorate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, moving right along, your business partner, Stephen Buser, MD, wrote a piece called "The Trump Complex, the John Wayne Archetype, and States of National Possession." So we can all relate to John Wayne.
Right. You know, he was trying to, I think, address that idea that you spoke earlier about how sometimes if we have a critique about Jungians in general, is that perhaps there's a certain passivity and interiority that can be almost excessive. And, you know, I think Steve's chapter addresses the idea that a complex can overtake us, that we become possessed by the complex. And so, you know, what he was trying to give a really shorthand illustration of, I think, is that, you know, deeply embedded in American psyche is this idea that there is a hero, often a quiet, solitary figure that can come in and rescue the situation from whatever, you know, danger imperils it. And that, you know, he kind of likened that to this archetype of a John Wayne figure.
You know, yeah, not just John Wayne, but all those Westerns that we grew up on a long time ago. They always had that scenario of this. You know, like I think of the Lone Ranger. Who was that masked man?
That masked man? Exactly, yeah. Right. And, you know, and I think he makes a point that that quality that's sort of deeply embedded, and especially when it's unacknowledged, can easily be tapped into, and we can be sort of caught up in a complex, if you will. And in this case, the complex would be that, you know, we are America first, for example. If you go back to Lindbergh's days, it's now being kind of rekindled, or make America great again. You know, and it's even funny that I think whether Donald Trump does this with full forethought, or he's just instinctively inclined this way, you know, when he makes remarks about how he alone can bring a result, you know, there may be many people who find that offensive, but they ought not to be naive. That idea of the lone savior who can come in and rescue taps into something that perhaps Steve has captured there, that is a very deep archetypal realm that is perhaps unique to the American spirit, the American culture.
Yeah, one of the points that he makes, that he introduces into this conversation that I think is really important, is the idea of a national complex. So in other words, as a nation, we have sort of a national psyche, if you will, and that has its its needs, its vulnerabilities, its hungers, and its blind spots.
Yes. And, you know, and at the risk of stirring controversy that is so easily inflamed in the Jungian world, you know, one of the things that I think we carry as part of our legacy, any of us who find Jung interesting, and certainly those who are analysts especially, one of the things we carry with us historically is that, you know, Jung wrote essays about the figure of Wotan in the Germanic culture. And, you know, many people, in fact, we're going to be publishing a book later this year on Jung's evolving views on Nazism and things. But you know, he was accused at times of being anti-Semitic.
Yes.
Apart from whatever people might say about that, you know, I think what he was trying to call attention to was there was something that was deeply embedded in the German people's history, mythologically, that Hitler did an extraordinary job of tapping into. And, you know, this idea that there was a powerful race that, you know, people may not need to know that that's part of their history to know that it still exists in fable. It still exists at that collective level. And that's probably true as well of our nation.
You know, going back to what we were talking about a little earlier about the national psyche and so on, one of the authors, I don't remember which one, said something that really hit home for me, is that our one aspect of our American myth is that we are the savior. You were talking about the John Wayne guy who rides up on the horse, but this is part of our self-image as a nation, that we are the savior, that we can democratize the world, that we can rescue people and so on, and that we have suffered a wound in that place with the tragedy of 9/11 and some of the other things that have happened since then, the financial collapse. And so we're not sure of ourselves anymore. And so many of us want to deny that and make America great again.
Right.
You know, so...
You talk about such a prominent principle that's well represented in Jungian thought, is this idea of transcending opposites. And, yes. And there's a good example that, absolutely, I think there's a great deal to be said. Steve mentions it. I think Tom Singer's chapter also mentions it, that, you know, we even have phrases for it now. If you think about the idea that's so often bantered around by pundits, of American exceptionalism, as if we are exceptional in a way that's even more exceptional than exceptional would ordinarily be, yeah. You know, and I think an argument can be made that gets even more stoked up by the fact that we have suffered some deep and humbling wounds. I mean, maybe it's my age that causes me to think I can go back to our defeat in Vietnam, the defeat of a president in his impeachment with Nixon, where, you know, the imperial presidency that we might have seen the last days of with Kennedy and Johnson saw its demise. And then we have, you know, the economic slide. And then you follow that with 9/11 and the fact that, you know, we have been meandering through. We went into Afghanistan and kind of retraced the steps of Russia, if you will. You know, I think some of those things we could make a case for have been collective wounds to the spirit of the nation. And so the antithesis of that is, how might we kind of recover a sense of our exceptional nature? And that's why I think, again, to the extent that we remain oblivious to those forces, we are more at risk of being ensnared by them, not just by an individual, but really as a society.
Yeah, some people want to sort of deny or gloss over that and say, hey, we are exceptional, we're great, we need to reclaim that. Then there are other people who are more of, hey, we have to own up to our losses. We have to own up to our own part in creating some of the problems that we see many of the problems that we see in the world. And so then the different political leaders can play to one side or the other of that conflict that actually exists within us.
You know, I have a naive hope, David, that maybe the passage through that could very well be that while we don't disown the fact that we are a really unique experiment in the American society, it's almost, it not only is unprecedented, but it's really almost unfathomable to think that we would try and pull together the kind of diversity that exists in this country and make it work. So in some ways, I think the challenge is, how can we hold both of those in tension? The fact that, you know, we are not an imperial nation that can that is a hegemony, you know, the sort of things that Noam Chomsky criticizes this country for and has for decades. Let's own that, but let's also not throw the baby out with the bathwater. The fact of the matter is that we still do remain the beacon, sort of the city on a hill toward which people look with great inspiration. I think that's the challenge, and maybe one of those unusual things that Jung and those of us who are Jungians can impart is that, you know, it's a high call to be able to transcend the opposites. And there you go. That's a challenge that's before all of us right now.
Yeah, yeah. You know, another interesting title in the book of one of the articles that caught my attention is Healthy Presidential Narcissism. Is that possible? That's Nathan Schwartz-Salent.
Right.
is that possible? Healthy,
is it possible?
Healthy presidential narcissism?
Well, you know, wouldn't it be nice to suppose so, first of all? And, you know, I actually think Nathan makes some very interesting points, including in there the fine distinction that we ought to make between narcissism that may be very self-promoting, may be very alluring and attractive, but that doesn't identify with itself. And he makes an important distinction that the unhealthy narcissistic path would identify with the self and think that one and the same. And, you know, I think that's the kind of thing that kings and sovereigns are certainly subject to, but then again, that is actually the role we put upon them, is I am the realm and the realm is me. But for a leader in a democratic society, that seems pretty ill-suited, to think that your own self is the same as the world around you, and that the world should mirror every small, nuanced, whimsical kind of passage that you go through as an individual. So I think that's what Nathan's chapter does a very good job of articulating, is that you know, there's a difference between being able to activate very inspiring, narcissistically inflated things that might lift up others along with you, provided you're not identified with it. And that might be the rub.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, on the topic of health, what I hope is healthy narcissism, I mean, I wouldn't be here doing this if I didn't. In part, it's my narcissism that says, hey, I can be on, people can see me on their computers around the world, and I can interview such a knowledgeable person such as yourself. You know, that's my narcissism. But hopefully it stays within check. I don't insist that everybody watch this interview.
Right.
As much as I might like that.
Yeah, and you know, and it goes back to something that I actually wrote about in my chapter. One of the reasons I invoked Alfred Adler that I thought would be useful to include is that, you know, he had this idea of the farther reaches of adult development could possibly include what something he referred to as social interest. It was the ability to nurture and cultivate a cooperative and collaborative attitude with others, and ultimately to serve the purposes of higher, somewhat selfless purposes. So, and in many ways, it's kind of the equivalent of what Erik Erikson would have referred to in those last two stages of his development that included like generativity and what was the other one? Ego integrity versus despair. You know, there comes a stage in life where if you're able to muster it, you might be still possessed of a certain narcissistic inflation. Yes, I want to be on the internet conducting interviews, but you also weave that into a broader context that hopefully will be of some service and value to others. And I think your listeners would certainly attest to the fact that, oh yeah, if there's any degree of narcissism on your part, it's more than compensated by the fact that what you're doing matters to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another intriguing title is Trump and the American Selfie.
And I just thought I'll tell you, that was the hardest chapter of all to edit.
Yeah. Why?
In large part because Tom Singer, you know, first of all, Tom Singer has a lot of depth of experience in, and really, in a sense, pioneered the idea of a cultural complex. So To begin with, he knows of what he speaks. And I'd say the other thing about Tom's chapter is he's probably the most unabashed in his characterizations. So if any of the chapters needed a heavier hand in terms of let's rein some things in, that might have been his. But, you know, in the end, what he's really espousing is this idea that Donald Trump is really I think he uses an opening line, something like he's got the longest selfie stick in America. And I think what he's pointing to is the fact that Donald Trump may be possessed of a lot of narcissistic traits, but he's also activated our own narcissistic traits, and that there's this complex going on that he has tapped into of, you know, reality television, celebrity standing. He makes a funny quip at some point that the only thing that bumped Donald Trump off of the front page of the news and on television for several months was, maybe some of the listeners will remember, when the gorilla, when a child fell into the gorilla cage.
Yes, I remember.
And then they had to eventually shoot the gorilla, and people were up in arms about the animal cruelty and one thing after another. And Tom makes a good point that that was about the only thing that could bring Donald Trump off the front pages, is a story about a gorilla. And I think it says something about our culture that, you know, not only that Donald Trump's become such a compelling figure, but that there's something about our own narcissism that's being unleashed here.
Well, he does characterize a large portion of Trump's followers in terms of the authoritarian personality typology. And so that would be those among us who most intensely hope for a strong leader, the strong man. They're ready to really support somebody who presents that image that, of course, speaks to all of us at some level, but more explicitly to some than others.
It is interesting, isn't it? And, you know, even those who might be the most vocal critics of his candidacy, I think would do well to take note that whether he's doing this with great instinct or with deliberate purpose, boy, he has been effective. He's been profoundly effective at tapping into something. And you're right. There is, again, that's part of why I think at the root of it, there may be a sort of a quality of inferiority that we all carry. You know, I remember when he was doing some of the early debates, and people would speak about, and it really did feel like he was like a schoolyard bully. You know, mm-hmm. He turns to Jeb Bush and he makes sort of derisive comments, and you could almost see some of these candidates sort of withering right there before us. And
it was shocking because he's violating unspoken norms.
Yes, right? We're supposed to put those childish things away after we leave the playground, and he didn't do it. But you know, what I found interesting is even candidates that I didn't like, Ted Cruz, for instance, no relation, I'd like to mention, but even candidates that I might have had some odium for myself, I found myself sort of feeling moved by, well, we've all either been the victim of a bully, we've been a bully ourselves, or we've been bystanders that who were guilty of not stepping in. And so I think as we witnessed that, he was stirring something that for most males is profoundly part of our identity. We've all been there in some form or another.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Well, another article I want to draw our attention to is by Clarissa Pinkel Estes, who wrote the very well-known book, Women Who Run with Wolves.
Yes.
Yeah, so I wanted to be sure to get her in here. And the title of her piece was How Bluebeard and Hitler Came to Power. Well, I'm not so interested in Bluebeard, but Hitler definitely is a hot button. And as all of this has been unfolding, you know, I can't help but keep thinking about Hitler and his rise to power. And, you know, you mentioned Wotan and the Teutonic myth that somehow just spoke to the German people at such a deep level. And it feels like there's something like that going on here. And a few of the authors make some reference to Nazism and so on.
It is interesting, isn't it, that, you know, the other chapter that I found particularly interesting to read, and it may be more a reflection of how ignorant I was of the subject before I read this chapter. One of the contributors is a professor at the University of North Carolina in Asheville, John McLean, and he writes a chapter about the aesthetic of fascism under the ascendancy of Benito Mussolini. Well, I confess I was oblivious to even the origins of the word fascist, that it comes from this notion that is ancient and represented well in Roman culture of binding together reeds with a cord. And by doing that, they take on a strength of their own. And it turns out what Mussolini did with great skill, and by the way, I didn't know this either, Mussolini was a very well-educated man. He actually took umbrage at Hitler, who was he perceived to be something of an uncouth ruffian, and was copying many of his strategies and techniques. But to give an example, one of the things that Mussolini did was he took this image of the fascist, this bundle of reeds tied together with cord, and he modernized it. He made it look sleek, and he did it in metal, and he then made it prominent. It was part of the uniform and part of many of the structures that he built. And what he was doing was he was tapping something that goes all the way back to ancient Rome and bringing it forward into the present in order to kind of activate an energy that people would be able to tap into. And that's very much like Hitler's use of the swastika, which is a very ancient and was never a malignant symbol. But once he co-opted it, you know, it has forever been sort of sullied and contaminated.
I like your phrase, activated energies. And that seems to be what a lot of this is about, are these archetypal energies that are out there in here and that they can become activated. And if you add the component of the mob to that, they can become irrational, very powerful, irrational, like a hurricane that comes in and just shakes everything up. And, you know, if we look through history, we see various periods of that where a strong, charismatic leader rises and brings these energies together. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we need to be aware of, I guess, right?
I really do think that that's perhaps, you know, one of the other things that actually gave birth to the idea of this book. Murray Stein posted something on Facebook back in March that on first glance horrified me. And the title of his post was, it was something written by somebody else that he was reposting. And it was titled, "Why Donald Trump May Be the Best Thing That Ever Happened to America." And you can imagine my first response was a little bit of bewilderment. Really, Murray? You did that? Well, so I opened the post and I read the article, and I don't remember who the author was, but the premise was really very sound, and it was that, you know, depending on what we do with this whole experience of the 2016 election and what it's unleashed, that it may very well be an opportunity for us to engage the shadow elements, both in ourselves individually and in ourselves collectively. And that was the author's premise, was that if that's what results from all this, that we take a more mature approach and perhaps we transcend some of these extremes, that we may look back on this one day and think that Donald Trump really was the best thing that ever happened to America. And in that regard, I would agree.
In the sense of a wake-up call, would you say?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the sense of a wake-up call to see that there really are these archetypal energies that can be easily unleashed. And that's not to say that we should be only terrified of their being released. In fact, they're a great wellspring of creative energy as well. It's just, what do we do with it? Do we use it to, in the most tribal, primitive ways, to divide and conquer? Or do we see that, maybe this is a moment to get beyond the tribalism and factionalism and perhaps get back to that original spirit of, out of many, one?
Yeah. Yesterday, I was able to watch part of a webinar that you guys are putting on where you've got some of the major Jungian figures talking about the very sorts of issues that we've been discussing here. How could my listeners find that webinar? Is it going to be out there for a while?
Well, one of the people who's in the room with me, our technician, Ryan Deegan, tells me that the best thing to do is to go to YouTube, where we have a YouTube channel, and simply type in, what's the title of it, Ryan?
Search for the Ashley Young Center Political Webinar.
Oh, he says if you just were to search for Ashley Young Center Political Webinar, it should be the only thing to appear.
Or
so,
if you visit our website, yeah. You can find it.
But, I mean, again, I think maybe that's one of the good news. By the way, the other chapter that that C.P. Estes wrote, which I think she has published in a slightly different form elsewhere, but I would really commend the listeners to go and read that chapter. I think we've even posted it on a website for free, but it's, I think, titled something like Do Not Lose Heart. You were born for, we were made for times like these. And it's a very inspiring idea that, yeah, it may look very dark and sinister and alarming and menacing, but really in the end, we're like ships that have lights at their prow. And although it may feel safe to stay at port, we really weren't meant for that. We were meant to go out in the open sea. And it kind of speaks to the idea that why now this book, it really isn't so much about, Donald Trump or the other candidates, it's really perhaps a call to action to engage the subject of narcissism.
Well, Lynn, I think that's a wonderful wrap-up, and so this might be a good place for us to end it. So, Dr. Leonard Cruz, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been a pleasure, and I'm sorry I avoided it for this many years, David. Thank you.
As you heard me remark during the interview, I really admire Dr. Lynn Cruz and Dr. Steve Buser for the courage to bring out this book and to stand up and be counted during this very controversial election season. If you get the book, you'll see that many of the contributors raise serious questions about Donald Trump's suitability for the presidency. This is an enormously important election, with implications not just for the United States, but for the whole world. Whatever happens, these contributors will at least know that they did not stay silent. It's too easy to sit safely behind our credentials and professional titles and professional distance. The temptation is strong to let other people deal with it, not to mention the fear that by stepping into the spotlight, one might be setting themselves up to be a target. So I think it's a courageous thing Drs. Cruz and Buser have done, along with the 16 other contributors to their book. In the book's preface, they list a number of quotes from Donald Trump. These would seem to speak very strongly for themselves, and I'd like to take the liberty of reading them to you now. "I get along with everybody. People love me. And you know what? I've been very successful. Everybody loves me. All of the women on The Apprentice flirted with me, consciously or unconsciously, that's to be expected. The greatest builder is me, and I would build the greatest wall you've ever seen. I've always been there. In school, I was always successful. In life, I was always successful. My father was a successful real estate developer, and he was a very tough man, but a good man. My father would always praise me. He always thought I was the smartest person. He said to one of the big magazines that everything he touches turns to gold at a very young age. So I don't know." In response to Spy Magazine's go-to qualifier of Trump as a short-fingered vulgarian, Trump told Page Six, "My fingers are long and beautiful, as it has been well documented are other parts of my body." "If I were a liberal Democrat, people would say I am the super genius of all time. The super genius of all time. if you're a conservative Republican, you've got to fight for your life. It's really an amazing thing. About the State Department, he says, I used to use the word incompetent. Now I just call them stupid. I went to an Ivy League school. I'm very highly educated. I know words. I have the best words, but there's no better word than stupid. I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me, and I'll build them very inexpensively. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. I think apologizing's a great thing, but you have to be wrong. I will absolutely apologize sometime in the hopefully distant future if I'm ever wrong. I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose voters. So as I say, I think these quotes speak for themselves, and they are but a small sample of the many egregious, boastful, attacking, bullying, rabble-rousing, and demeaning things he's said. You heard me mention a video webinar on this topic, and you can find it by going to http://AshevilleJungCenter.org. That's spelled AshevilleJungCenter.org. Finally, as always, you're encouraged to order the book, A Clear and Present Danger, Narcissism in the Era of Donald Trump, by going to our Amazon affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar. And we'll get a few cents added to our coffers there as well.
Well, hello, Dr. Dave. We would like to thank you for such a wonderful podcast. Although we just started listening a few months ago, we want to contribute financially to all the generous and genuine work you put into each interview. Having been teachers for many years, we know how valuable it is to understand human development. Your podcasts are both particular and comprehensive. By interviewing such accomplished professionals, you help point us toward great books to read and new discussions to have. You have kindled our passion for lifelong learning again. From the Northwest, thank you so very, very much, Jim and Colleen. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim and Colleen. I just brought you another outstanding and timely book. I hope you'll agree. And if you're not already a financial supporter, I hope you'll join Jim and Colleen as a donor. In fact, we have no new donors or transcripts since the last episode. We do have a relatively new sponsor that I've mentioned before, and it's Bombas Socks. I've been an ongoing customer of theirs for several years. And why? Because of the bright colors and the distinctive patterns and how well they're made, as well as the fact that they provide socks for both men and women in various lengths, including the little shorties that are great for summer tennis. Also, I appreciate their philanthropic commitment to provide a pair of socks to a homeless person for every pair you order. So if you're a listener in the U.S., you can save 20% off your first order by going to getbombas.com/shrinkwrapradio. Bombas is spelled B-O-M-B-A-S. And also there's a banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on our site that you can click on. And if you're a user of our app, our Shrink Wrap Radio app, about which you can find information in the apps tab on our site, you may have noticed that I've been able to, once again, start putting up short video previews a day or so before the next interview. And I hope you're enjoying and appreciating that extra work on my part. If you don't have our app, it's available for all smartphones. As I say, just go to the apps tab at Shrink Wrap Radio for full information. And also remember, you can find both the video preview of the interview and the full video of the interview on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/shrinkwrapradio.
Hi, this is Dr. Ben Caldwell, marriage and family therapist and author of the book Saving Psychotherapy, How Therapists Can Bring the Talking Cure Back from the Brink. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Ben Caldwell, who really will be my guest on the next episode. I know I said that last time, but I needed to squeeze in today's podcast when the opportunity presented itself. Now, let's go to a recent email from our listener community. It's from Penelope Andrade, who was my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. It's from Penelope Andrade, LCSW, who was my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 378, Emotional Medicine with Penelope Young Andrade, LCSW. Penelope writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I hope you're enjoying some summer fun. I recently read a wonderful book while I was in the High Sierras, Tea and Freud, by the psychiatrist Dr. Steven Sandler. I'm going to paste in the review I wrote for two therapy listservs, AEDP and ISTDP. Here goes, quotes, "I thoroughly enjoyed reading Steven Sandler's Tea with Freud. Although I was in the High Sierras, surrounded by ponderosa pines and crisp mountain air while reading, I was transported to Europe, Freud's office, Dr. Sandler's office in Albany, New York, and a riveting mano-a-mano grapple with the exposition and application of the ideas that form the foundation of our work. As a writer myself, I so appreciated the light touch, grace, charm with which Dr. Sandler was able to weave historical psychoanalytic notions, compelling case transcripts, touching personal revelations into a gripping evolutionary tale. I loved learning so much so effortlessly. I particularly appreciated the ending. Dr. Sandler not only offered a poignant, synthesizing case description highlighting the healing power of positive relationship, but tied everything together with some important ideas coming from Bruce Ecker and our friends in the memory reconsolidation and mindfulness fields. Wow. I've already given away my first copy, now ordering more to have on hand for sophisticated clients. I'll be recommending this book to friends and colleagues for years to come. Thank you, Steven Sandler." End quote. So, Dave, whether you decide to interview Dr. Sandler or not, you do have a treat in store for you when you read his book. I'm copying him on this email if you'd like to request a review copy. I remember my own interview on Shrink Wrap Radio fondly. Thanks again for that good time. Warmly, Penelope. Well, Penelope, thanks so much for that recommendation. I did reach out to Dr. Sandler for a review copy, which I have, but haven't had a chance yet to take a look at. So I will take a look at it, and I have to decide whether or not it's material that would go well for an interview or not. So it's still a possibility. We'll see. So I think that should wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember, in addition to emails, you can always leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail either using our app or our message phone at 415-830-4014. Well, I want to thank today's guest, Dr. Leonard Cruz, once more, for sharing his insights into narcissism in the era of Donald Trump. And as I mentioned earlier, my next interview will be with family therapist Ben Caldwell, who is the author of the 2016 book, Saving Psychotherapy, How Therapists Can Bring the Talking Cure Back from the Brink. This should be another good one. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.